Hi, my name is Chris Doe, and this is Uncommon.
Uncommon is a production focused on the why of business, media, and marketing. It's made by my team at Neural, a digital agency for challenger brands and talent. To learn more, just visit neural.com. That's N-E-U-R-A-L-L-E.com. My guest this week, Chris Doe, founder and CEO of The Future, CEO of Blind Ink, advisor to Saleshood, and keynote speaker. Chris, thanks for coming on. It's nice to chat to someone in the US. And I've got to say ahead of time, thanks for introducing me to David C. Baker, because that guy and Blair Eanes have changed, I reckon in the last year in particular, have absolutely changed my world. So you were like the gateway drug to those guys. So I've got to preemptively thank you for that. Curious how you found David.
I found David probably through Blair Eanes.
Okay.
I can't remember, but I bought his book and I hadn't read it.
Yeah.
And then he sent me a copy of his book. So I was like, hey, man, read it. So it's neat when an author actually sends you a book. It shows you that they care and you're at least on their radar. But I heard of David Baker actually before I heard of Blair Eanes. So let me see if I got my chronology right here. I was having lunch with one of my friends from Art Center. His name is Fabian Gerhalter. And he tells me about this guy who he met with who charges, at that time, $10,000 a day to meet with him. And you have to pay for his airfare and his hotel. But he was lucky because David was in town, so he didn't have to take care of the hotel or the airfare. And so they wound up working with David, and David changed his business and his life. That's how I found out about David's name. But I didn't really read his book until much later, until I started to talk to Blair Eanes. So those right. Two, as you know, are thick as thieves.
They are thick as thieves. And I think anyone listening to this who likes your work, who runs an agency or a media or creative business, or really any expertise business, you should be listening to what these guys are up to. It's very, very interesting stuff. And for me, having come from, I was always on the client side, like working in marketing and sales. And so coming into the business, my wife and co-founder in our agency, she was the creative and I was the business guy. And so to understand the business side of things from those guys and yourself was very intriguing. For anyone who is in this space, they should definitely have a look. Now, childhood, what's your earliest memory?
My earliest memory, it's vague because I think it's pre-language. It's like me sitting in a little tub of water, taking a bath. And sitting on the floor. And I think it's from Vietnam. I can't confirm it because my mom's like, no, that never happened. But it's pretty clear in my mind. And it's probably because one of my aunties was bathing me.
Yeah, right. Which part of Vietnam was Saigon. Your family from? Saigon. Okay.
Yeah, from the south, yeah.
And, you know, I know as a kid, your dad, he was an engineer. He worked at a semiconductor company. Mm-hmm. Your mom as well. Well, she worked at IBM, but at heart, she was a bit of an artist. I think from memory, it seems like both of them had at least 8 to 11 siblings, actually. Similar to my mum.
Right.
She was one of 10.
Yeah.
So
big family.
Big, big family. On the dad's side, on your dad's side, all very engineering focus. On your mum's side, poets, painters, artists.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, as someone who's stuck in between those type of individuals, and I had a similar upbringing, and my dad's family was very regimented, very structured, business owners, printers, engineers, all that sort of stuff. And then mum's family was quite open and creative. I'm curious from your perspective, what did you think as a kid you were going to be when you grew up?
Yeah, it wasn't easy for me to reconcile these two parts of who I was, the creative and the practical engineering side, the logic side, because the thing is, I had a lot of fun. I felt most like myself making things, finding things on the street and just cobbling them together to make playsets for my Star Wars action figures, just taking a little knife and a little bit of glue and a little imagination and making stuff. And some of my earliest, happiest memories are around creating. Like when I was 7 years old, I think I got a pack of markers and a pad of paper and I pushed all the other gifts aside. I'm like, this is what I'm going to be spending my time doing.
Uh-huh.
But growing up, especially as immigrants to the United States, there weren't a lot of introductions or immersion into culture, into art and music and theater. So it's really to go to school and play with your neighborhood kid friends and then what? So I didn't really think of design and art and illustration as a profession. So I was on that same path of like, let's study the sciences and figure out a respectable career to have and work 9 to 5 at a job. And it wasn't until I met a real life graphic designer when I was 17 years old working at a silk screening shop that I even knew a graphic designer was a thing. Because before then, my image of artists were people who drew caricatures and airbrushed on t-shirts. But when I met this gentleman, his name is Dean Walker, seeing him in his computers and his drawing instruments and markers, that to me was like everything I ever wanted in my life. I just didn't know it existed. And so Dean essentially gave me permission to become a designer.
So as a kid, you were talking before about when you had the options between gifts or activities, you would prefer to sit down and work with markers, let's say. What was it about it that you enjoyed? Like, what was mentally going through your head as a kid? Was it like a flow state? Was it just pure enjoyment? Why did you prefer that over the other?
Okay, very good question. So I just want you to know, because we came to the United States after the fall of Saigon, there wasn't a lot of money or resources growing up. I distinctly remember moments in my childhood where there's no tape, no scissors, no nothing in the house. You're trying to find something to make anything, to make a drawing. I was fascinated by comic books and the idea of pop culture, but the tools were very limited. So getting a pack of, like, I don't know if it was 12 markers, I was like, well, this is unlimited potential to me. Uh-huh. And you can create something. You can express something that's in your mind on a piece of paper. Because every opportunity I got, whether it was in class or with one of my uncles who liked to draw, I just sat there and drew with them. And I just to make something from nothing felt so rewarding.
Interesting. So it sounds like it was an innate part of your like personality. And when you had that opportunity to express yourself, it was sort of like almost like a pouring out, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's one of those things where maybe perhaps prior to discovering lemonade or something, you'd never had lemonade and somebody gives you like the most perfect glass of lemonade and you drink it and you say, where have you been all my life? What is this thing you call, you know, what am I holding? What is this amazing liquid? Oh, it's lemonade. Right.
It's so funny. It reminds me of videos you see on like social media when like kids sub 1 years of age and they're like introduced to the first like Coke or like chocolate cake is a common one that I see, and because they can't speak. So all you see is their emotive physical reaction and you give them that cake and they're just like they light up completely. It's quite fascinating. It's very funny. Growing up, was there a lesson or principle that you still hold today that you pulled from your childhood that maybe your parents did or said or something you experienced indirectly? Like the example I would give for myself is growing up in my father's a Greek immigrant, and all I knew from an early age was business, like being sat on a shelf in his printing factory, the smell of fresh paper, him never being around because he was always working and slugging away at this sort of stuff. And so indirectly, I learned about hard work. So I was curious, what was the thing for you as a kid?
Yeah, I think all of us, no matter how much we want to admit it or not, are shaped by the experiences and lessons taught from us, whether we're paying attention or not, from both our parents. And I got to see quite a little bit, of course, in my adolescent mind. It doesn't all quite make sense, but it makes an impression on you. My mom is a really super creative person. She paints in oils, pastels. You give her something, she's going to make something, and she would make her own clothes. She would make our clothes, and she could cut hair. There's a lot of things that she could do. And I think that if she were born in this country from parents that were creative and open-minded, she would have been a totally different person today. And later on in her career, working at IBM using CAD tools, she had severe carpal tunnel in both of her wrists. So she had to have surgery. So I could just see my mom having two scars along her wrists, right, or along these parts of her hand, and wearing a brace and having pain doing the thing that she loves, which is painting. And so you see that life is short and things happen. And do you want to live your entire life not scratching that itch and not going for it? Just that one shot that you never took, and now that opportunity passes you by. And she's a busybody, so she keeps herself busy with stuff. But I was thinking, if my mom was raised here and given those opportunities, she might have gone to a school of performing arts. She might have been an incredible artist in her own right, doing ceramics and just kind of being this Renaissance woman. And so I got that from my mom. And I can see that from all her siblings, my many cousins and aunts, that they too tried to pursue their creative life. They were much younger, so they had more opportunities available to them, but they couldn't connect the dots. So though they were happy and passionate people, they weren't successful in the business sense. And then you flip to my dad, and his whole side of the family is very much the same, very logical, right-brained, work hard. Some are attorneys, engineers, some are dentists. You know, so they're all kind of in that very professional state, and they're doing well in their lives. And my dad, not having, you know, he learned how to speak English in America. He had to come up the hard way. His first job was to bus tables at a bar restaurant. Then he learned how to mix drinks, and he just worked his way up. And so growing up, yeah, I didn't see a whole lot of my dad. He was up at the crack of dawn before I woke up for school, and it was dark before he got home. And he's a very quiet, reserved, humble man. And you know, you hear this a lot about families where the big piece of chicken is for dad. Dad works the hardest. My dad's not like that. He's like, you kids eat the chicken. I'll eat whatever's left. And so He always put himself second. Being the oldest male of many brothers and sisters himself, and his father, my grandfather, passed away when he was really young. And so my dad had to grow up really fast and become the father to his many brothers and sisters. And so he's a guy who really instilled in me delayed gratification, sacrifice, hard work, and giving to others. And that's what he did. He always put himself second. To this day, he refuses things that he would consider luxury or unnecessary. And I'm like, Dad, we only have this life left.
Yeah.
And so we see on him, the lesson is you can work hard, you can do all the right kinds of things, but you have to learn to love life too. Mm-hmm. And it's that balance between the expressing of yourself, the love of life, and your one shot at it. And also saying it's not all about work, because at the end of the day, there's more to life than just work.
Yeah. You need to smell the roses a bit. I think I've learned from my wife's family quite a lot, because my dad's like that. He's set in life now. He does not need to worry about money. He's that classic case of like immigrant family background works. It's that immigrant mentality. They work too hard and then they don't know how to spend their money once they've got it. And I'm just like, well, you know that like us and our eventual kids and my siblings, we will all inherit this. So you may as well just spend it and enjoy your life. Curious, what do you wish that you could say more often to your parents that you don't?
I don't know. That's a good question. I try to say whatever it is I need to say to them. They live not too far away from us. It's a 20-minute drive. We see them every other weekend or something like that. They come over often. And my mom and dad are constantly doing stuff for us because they want to try to take care of us, even though I'm almost 50 years old. My mom's cooking different dishes and bringing them over. So I have to tell her, Mom, no human being can eat this much food. So now we're going to be eating this every single day for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So just a little bit goes a long way. And, you know, that's the only way she knows how to provide for her children and her grandchildren. So she does what she does. My thing is, I just wish for both of them that they will learn to relax and to enjoy the life at some point. Just relax.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I've got a very similar thing. All right. So your early studies, high school, Santa Teresa High School in San Jose, I think it was. Mm-hmm. Am I correct? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Graphic design at City College. You then eventually went on to do a bachelor's, it seems. You had quite the prolific career early on. Colin Weber, RGA, Epitaph Records. You then worked for, it seems like at least 7 years as an adjunct instructor and then moving to the Board of Governors. So quite an extensive time teaching, and you've always had a teaching function of your life or a teaching component. That's peppered throughout your career and other roles as well. Too many public speaking gigs to count now. Too many board organizations. One of the interesting ones I found was you're working on the Emmys Title Design Peer Group, which was mm-hmm. quite interesting. All of that, running your own design consultancy as well. Clearly, you're not a fly-by-night operator in the industry, which can happen for a lot of people. You are here as a career design professional. What do you think has been for you personally the highs and lows of the last 20 years?
probably the highest professional achievement for me is winning the Emmy for art direction for the music video that I directed. Mm-hmm. And it's because it's like, that's not my normal world. And you see a lot of beautiful, fancy people, and you win an award that actually people have heard of versus something that only people in the industry have heard of.
Yeah.
And so it's an easy reference point for people. I think to this date, we've probably won more than 30 or 40 awards. I've lost track, but the one that people seem to connect with and resonate with, oh, you've won an Emmy? Okay.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty high professional achievement. Also being written up in a local entertainment and culture magazine called LA Weekly. Mm-hmm. That was pretty cool. It was titled From Saigon to Santa Monica. And being featured in the Thanksgiving issue was pretty cool because there was a lot for me to be thankful for. But all that stuff is really just about me learning to learn how to tell stories and to make things at the highest level, making commercials and music videos for brands and bands that I've always dreamt of working with. I think that's pretty cool. And it's just one of those things where sometimes you step back and you say, is this my life? Like, what did I do in a previous life that I have these opportunities? Because I thought I was going to make $25,000 a year working on brochures and catalogs. That was the destiny that I had charted for myself. And life takes interesting twists and turns. And you, if you go with the right moment, you go right down the right path and you catch that wave, things can be great.
Mm. What about the lows? What was the lowest moment career-wise?
And this has happened to me a couple of times when our business slows down and we hit financial, we have to pump the brakes and I have to like let people go, people I care about, people I like. And people I want to have around me. And it's really, really difficult. So every time we've had this, and I think we've had probably 3 rounds of layoffs in our company throughout the years, 25 years, there are moments where I have to course correct, where I have to sit down with 3 or 4 people and say, look, man, company's going a different direction. I'm super sorry, but I got to let you go. And it's a tough conversation. It hits people on a very personal level, some of which still are upset at me. And I'm like, I'm sorry. I don't know what else to do, right? In order for us to survive, we have to make some hard decisions and we have to let a few people go. And so those are always the lowest points.
Yeah, I've had that recently. I mean, obviously, I was mentioning to you off air, we've been in, it's a very weird time here in Australia because we are now in Victoria, the state of Victoria. Melbourne is the capital city. So second biggest city in Australia. We're in our 6th lockdown. We've had 210 days of lockdown out of 365. So it's been a long, long time. Now, the business has pivoted and we've done really, really well and we've grown through all of that. But this last lockdown in particular, I noticed there was a complete shift and it got to the point where, unfortunately, we had a good staff member who was poached by a competitor simply because there was just not enough work. And, you know, we couldn't compete with that. And I would agree. I think losing... it was terrible because she's crying while she's telling us and she knows that the opportunity for us as a business is what she wants, but there's also a financial reality, which sucks. Yeah. But yeah, it really sucks here at the moment because, you know, we've got massive shipping issues, clients paying freight up 300%. So yeah, I know what all of that is like. And in hindsight, it's easy to comment on, but in the moment when you're in it, it's like the worst thing in the world. Like you think your life is ending.
It takes something away from you. Yeah. I think if there's such a thing as events that take years from your life or days or months, these things do take something away from you for sure.
They do for sure. Now, if you look at that this time and you would condense them into a group of golden principles for running your own consultancy. So this is specific to running a consultancy versus an education business like The Future. Mm-hmm. What are those golden principles to you since starting that firm in 95?
Some of the principles of running a service design business?
Yeah.
I think making sure your pipe is full with marketing, with lead generation, with client building, client services, maintaining relationships. I think all those things contribute to a steady flow of potential opportunities. And that's not something we've always been great at. In my life, I've taken for granted that work will come because getting work has been, for the most part of my career, not that difficult to come by. And so I take those relationships for granted. And I'm reminded of that because every once in a while I work with someone and their customer service game is on point. And it makes me reflect to think, man, I've had way more business from other clients and I've taken poor care of them. Thinking that for some point in time in my life that taking care of people meant doing excellent work, doing what you say and saying what you do. Mm. But there's more to this because when people have a choice and they do, they're going to choose people who are genuinely appreciate them. And being an antisocial introvert, a very shy person, I just don't like being around people, at least in the past. And it's why I've always shied away from going to the client dinners and I've sent my team. And so they don't know who I am. They have no idea. They have no relationship with me. And so when people move on, they move on with them. Mm. And I'll share it in a very simple story. So I'm in the office and we're not in the office much these days because of the pandemic and there's no reason to be there. We just do things remotely. And I check my voicemail and there's a lot of voicemails there. And one of them is my realtor, the guy who facilitated me buying the house that I'm in. Now, I haven't spoken to him face-to-face in a number of years, but he leaves a message. I know it's a sales call. He leaves me this message and he says, "Hey, Chris, checking in on you and Jesse." That's my wife's name. I just wanted to share this fun fact with you. You've now lived in your home for, I think he said 14 years. And I just wanted to share that with you. As always, I appreciate your business. And if you need anything, don't hesitate to call me. And I'm sure he's sitting there literally going through his Rolodex and calling everybody on their anniversary. And that's what he does. But I was just sitting there thinking, look, I haven't done business with you, but he's staying top of mind. So that if I want to sell my home, or if I want to buy a home, or if I want to recommend an agent or a broker in the neighborhood, I'm going to recommend him. Mm. And it's wonderful that he does that. And I hear how other people take the customer service game to the very next level. And I was reading this book. It's called The Truth of Service or something like that. And they share stories in there and they say the whole point of customer service is you're creating memories. Mm. What's the memory that people are going to take away? So people go to Disneyland because it's an experience and they see things. But what they remember is that time that mom and dad made them feel like they're the most important thing in their lives. And that connection with the smells coming down Main Street, the vanilla waffle smell and the music and the cleanest, happiest place on earth. And it's magical and we forget reality and we forget that sometimes we don't agree with each other and we're fighting with our siblings and those kinds of things. So we create those memories and they stick. They stick to you in ways that other things do not.
Okay. So number one, and I think this is something that you've spoken about repeatedly on the future. And like I was saying before, Blaine's, he's another one who speaks about it a lot, is ensuring that deal flow is continually there. And part of that would be that customer service element. What's number two?
Of deal flow or just...
No, of your golden point. Of your golden of principles. Golden rules. Yeah.
Number two, and it might even exceed number one, which is to always be looking out on the horizon to spot cultural trends, shifts in technology, changing consumer behavior and needs so that you're out ahead of it. And I tell my team this, I need the most amount of free time because while we're all doing the work and making money and making sure we're profitable, someone has to be up in that perch on the crow's nest of the ship to make sure we're not running into pirates, not running into an iceberg or just lost at sea. And sometimes that can happen. You can be drunk on the illusion of success and the momentary spike and high of like what's happening when business is flowing, but the tides change quickly and you can go from a sunshiny, clear skies kind of day into inclement weather and be caught off guard. So I tell them like, I need time. And I do spend that time. I read magazines. I talk to people. I interview people. And I'm constantly on the lookout for like what might sideswipe us in the future so that we can avoid that. And we've seen that happen many times because when you run a company for 25 years, about every 5 years, you're going to face some sort of disruption. If you don't rise to meet that challenge, you're going to be in a state of decline. So for us, our last big pivot was going from doing commercials and music videos to doing brand work and doing client direct.
Interesting. You know, looking back on that in hindsight, is there any key indicators for when that moment is happening and when you physically feel that you need to make that change? Like, is it something that just you know, innately comes into your brain because you've been all consuming this information, and you realize and you start to connect the dots like brains do, because we are just essentially pattern making or pattern searching individuals. Is that the moment?
Yes and no. I think every time I look back, the writing's on the wall, the messenger's been knocking at the door, leaving slips under your door and in your mailbox, but you just refuse to see it because we're attached to our past. We have a clear definition of who we are, and despite the opportunity that exists, it's better and safer for us to hold on to the old thing. I remember this conversation with my executive producer. I said, I'm concerned that people are no longer watching TV and therefore no longer watching commercials. And guess what? We're in the commercial making business. And so the demand for the work is going away. I can see that in the numbers. It's not obvious just yet, but I can see that instead of growing, we're starting to top off and slip into decline. The number of opportunities are getting fewer. We're facing more competition. The jobs are getting less creative. And he's like, Chris, don't be an alarmist. We'll be fine. There's always room at the top. And it's like, you're admitting that the boat is sinking, but we're at the highest spot of the boat, so we won't die first, but we will eventually die. And I walk away thinking, you know what? I have to take matters into my own hands. If you wait for all the information to be clear, it'll be too late. It'll just be too late. So part of this is understanding that I think we have a leak in the boat and there's another boat. It's not as seaworthy, but I believe this is the boat we need to get on. So everybody that wants to get on, let's go. Mm. And it's a leap of faith. And you have to do that. And what happens is that as you sail away and one boat goes one direction and it's disappearing on the horizon, you do have doubts. You ask yourself, did we make the right decision? And I'm still here. I'm still kicking, sometimes screaming. So I think we've made the right decision.
What if I told you the way to take your brand to the next level in 2021 is with TikTok ads? A lot of our clients come to us with a problem. They need to take their brand to the next level. They're typically doing 5 to 10K a month, and they need to jump to that 25, 50K per month level. And Instagram and Facebook just isn't what it was. So what's the commonality amongst all this? It is primarily opportunity in a saturated market. And we think that TikTok ads today is the answer. Now, Narelle follows a two-phase process to guide you as a challenger brand on the way to growth. Phase one is all about knowing your brand and niche back to front with a focus on breaking even or getting above a break even. Phase two is scaling that creative to blow up your sales in the process once we've secured you as the leader in that niche on TikTok. You do this with the right partner, a committed partner like Narelle, and you'll build that confidence in an area that has typically been saturated in the past. There's not a silver bullet, and we'd love to chat to you. So book in a consultation with our specialist team. Just go to narelle.com/TikTok. That's NERALLE.com/TikTok. And we'll chat to you from there. Can I ask why, you know, if you look at commercial and TVC type stuff, the obvious pivot to me would have been, I don't know what year this was, by the way, the obvious pivot to me would have been something more like digital ads or social ads, but you made the jump to brand. Why was that the right decision for you guys?
Yeah, so I think it's going to be hard for people to process this, but I started my design firm in 1995 at the age and the dawn of the internet. I literally remember calling my brother when I was working at the ad agency, Colton Weber. I asked him, what is the internet? Like, this is like me asking Morpheus, you know, whoa, what's the internet? And he's like, okay, it's a bunch of computers connected together, developed by the military. I'm like, no, what is the internet? And so it's hard for people to understand that. I bring that up because what is social media? What is Instagram? What is Facebook? Like, why are people doing these things? This seems odd. And like many people, as a quote unquote old timer, I just register a name, register an account, and I'm like, let's see where this goes. So you're never quite sure if this is a passing trend. I remember there was a time when Google was not the dominant search engine. Mm. It was a whole bunch of other things. And then Google destroyed everyone, right? And so you're living in a time that's very tumultuous, changing technology. So as quickly as one thing rises, another thing falls, from Friendster to MySpace and then to Facebook, each was just a better version of the previous one and it replaced it. And so when we see things like commercials, and we, just to put things in perspective, a commercial that we would work on a low end, the budget would be $150,000. On the higher end, it'd probably be $600,000-$700,000. And so when you're looking at the kind of budgets for social content, social ads, right, you're talking about what, $4,000-$5,000?
Yeah.
We don't even know what, like, you can't even buy a storyboard from us for that. So that's the problem. And it's, the dinosaur can't move as nimbly as the mammals, and we're too big, we're too slow, and we don't know how to do things for less money. I literally had to sit down with my team and say, hey, you remember when you were a student and you knew how to stretch $500 and you made something look like $60,000? We need to put that hat on and think like that. And it's hard for them because they're used to having producers that cost $800 a day. Just like, okay, what are we doing? And then you've already burnt $30,000.
Yeah.
It's hard for them to shift.
Okay. That's really interesting. So it would not only, it's not so much the go-to-market, but it was the product market fit, or the product fit that needed to be transposed from the old model into this new model. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense. If we look back at those two numbers, so always looking forward and your marketing flow, is there anything else you think that we've missed in terms of golden principles?
Yeah, I think the last one, and I think these principles, one is not more important than the other. And I think they're all related. It's a triangle. Without the other side, it's just a line.
Yeah.
Right. So the third one is about culture.
Okay.
You design culture, how you want to behave as a company, your core values, your principles, your beliefs. And the reason why I tell you this story or this information is because not having a clearly defined culture allowed us to hire and keep people who are super supremely talented, but were extremely toxic and volatile. And looking back, I should have had more courage and been braver to say, this is going to hurt us creatively. Everything is going to hurt us so bad, but I got to let you go because you're just killing everybody. Mm-hmm. You really are. And I'll give you a couple examples, okay? I had a woman who worked for me, super bright, hardworking, dedicated, focused, creative person. Probably did some of the best work at this at our company. And she was like drama queen. Instead of booking people for her team, she would steal people from another team who are actively working on another project, saying, I don't want to hire anybody. I want those people. And then my other creative director was like, what do I do? Like, I don't know. And so it took a long time for me to say, you know what? That's not working for us. Let's just take a break. And it also comes from like my executive producer, and I have many. And so he would like just drive me insane, second guessing the creative team, always nervous about things, and then agreeing to do work and not going to bat for the team. So he created a division between sales and production. And it's one company. It's not like we have a million people working for us. We have 15. And I remember he and other executive producers drove away some of my best creative people. So I should have been brave to protect that core talent, that team, to let go of crazy creatives and to let unsure, nervous producers go too. And it wasn't until I started to literally write down our core values that started that change, because we had a company that I was not thrilled to go to work at. And there was a lot of passive aggressive energy coming from me and from other people. It's like, this is weird. What am I doing at this company? I don't even want to work here anymore, and I own it. So you got to protect the culture.
It's very interesting. I always remember this quote from Buffett. I don't know the specific quote, but the context is that you should always give praise in a group setting, but negative feedback should always be in a private setting. And the thing I learned from that is that you do need to pull people aside and have really strong conversations to nip things in the bud there and then. Because in group settings, it's awkward as fuck. Like it's so awkward to, and because you're dealing with, you're human, right? You're dealing with a social aspect as well as a business aspect. And it's so hard if you see this behavior in a group to either call it out or say something about it without coming across as a bit of a douche. So that's the dilemma you have running a business, but I would agree. So we've got our three, the future, content, courses, and tools. You know, I think I said earlier, as someone who worked more on the client side and was brought into this business or this industry by my wife, who's a creative director, I would say your YouTube content changed my life. Like there's no other channel. When I was searching specific keywords, there was no other channel that existed for what I needed, and it fit it perfectly. It was incredibly valuable. I found people like David C. Baker from it, who taught me sort of that creator economics or expertise economics of the industry. I'm sure many people thank you for your work when they meet you, but I was curious, what do you wish they told you about the future and its impact on their career?
I think I already get whatever it is that I could hope for in creating content. Hearing it from mouths like yours, seeing in the DMs and people having all kinds of success stories from all over the world in places where people would be shocked. Like when I get messages from first world countries, it's to be expected. But when I get them from third world or developing countries, I'm like, good for you. You're making more than 8 times the average income of someone, and you just apply the principles.
Okay.
That's what you do. So having that kind of success and fulfillment, or people saying, you know what, I almost gave up on myself, not in life, but just in design and creativity, and you gave me the fuel to keep moving forward. I'll watch this video just feeling really down, and you gave me insight and clarity on something. And I don't know what it is, but they feel it because they say it. So there's nothing that I wish they would tell me.
It must be like, because you've got the blind ink. You know, what's it like when you've got something like the future that is sexy and new and it's pulling you away from a business like that? Like, how do you split your time up?
I'm going to be just very direct with you. I struggle with this. If I could, I would have conversations with people like you all day. I'd coach 100 people at a time and just be on social platforms trying to help people because I want to be a teacher to the world. And then I neglect the business. I'm not writing posts. I'm not creating courses, the things that actually make us money. I'm not doing brand deals, and I don't want to do any of that stuff, but I have to because I have a team to support and they depend on me. And so I would rather just frolic about and help people and have a good time. And that's what gives me the joy of my life. If somebody had asked me this on Clubhouse, they said that if you don't have to run your company and money were no issue, what would you do? I said, well, I think I'd do exactly the same thing. I would read, I would talk, I would share, and I would teach, and I would have conversations with people. Except for now, I just don't even think about the money aspect anymore. Yeah. So if there are any rich benefactors out there who want to give like a boatload of money to us to support these kinds of ideas, I'm happy to take it.
Yeah, you should turn the future into a non-for-profit and just get people to donate to the cause. I don't know if that'd work, but... That would be quite funny. So you've lived we live today in this networked age. I know you've spoken many times about how important it is to create your own personal brand, especially as a creative. And, you know, thinking about how our firm sits within, our agency sits within the creator economy with a focus on talent, I would say. So we've had a front row seat to how creators live and breathe personal brand. But I was just curious from your perspective, what do you think that creators get? Like when I say creators, I mean like influencers, people who are punching out content in this low attention environment. What do you think that they get that designers and professionals in the ad industry or the creative industry just don't understand?
I think they grew up in a time where they had the neuroplasticity to accept a different reality that was very different from the one that came before it. In the old model, a few people, the gatekeepers, if you will, editors of magazines, curators of museums, executive executors of whatever, art buyers, art directors, and they got to decide who was going to be king. So they were king or queen maker. And it was a very narrow door in which you had to squeeze through. And there were a lot of people in front of you trying to get through those doors. And when you got through, you felt like, I'm the chosen anointed one and I'm meant to do this thing. And you ride that for as long as you can. And when you fall out of favor, your career is kind of done. And we've seen this happen time and time again. And if you think of an example that everyone can relate to, you think of the music industry the way it was, which was somebody in talent, and they would recruit new and upcoming bands. They would go to bars and listen to things, little hole in the wall venues, and find the next big act. They would sign them. They would groom them. I'd sign them a producer, give them a big marketing push. And when you're signed to a big label, you felt like you made it. You would get radio play, your records would sell out, and your concert or your tour would sell out, and it was great. That's the old way. The new way is you drop a track on SoundCloud, you do your own promotion, you blow up, then the record labels come to you and you negotiate the deal that you want that works for you, or you just self-publish. You take control of your life and your career and you negotiate hard for yourself. You still need some of those instruments and distribution channels, but you don't need them like the way we used to. So the creators in this creator economy, they've already recognized that they don't need a middle person, middleware. They have a direct connection and access to the people who want to support them. So they create content in the form of podcasts, YouTube videos, and Instagram. They write posts, Medium, whatever it is. And they build, I think, what Kevin Kelly calls your 1,000 true fans, yeah. Right? And they support them. And I love that because now the tastemaker are gone. You have much more diverse and niched content for all kinds of people because we don't have to be mainstream. And there was this great ad that I saw in the 90s by Doc Martens, the shoe boot company, kind of their anti-culture thing. Mm-hmm. And there was this line they wrote, the mainstream is polluted. Okay. And you don't have to go mainstream.
Yeah, I like that. And I agree. I think one of the things that creators have over creatives is that because, like you said, they've come from an era where they aren't reliant on that gatekeeper. They've also come from an era where they've invested their time in not relying on the gatekeeper. So a lot of it's not a form of cognitive dissonance, but if you're a graphic designer who's scared about going out and relying on sort of a base of true fans, let's call it, or followers, so to speak, to draw your business and not referrals and relationships and customers that come to you and tell you what to do rather than asking you what they should do, it can definitely be very scary. And particularly when there's money on the line that you need to pay the bills, it's a hard transition. It's a very hard transition. You've spoken about attention, what we were mentioning before, constant waves of this. You ran in the dot-com bubble, the GFC. It's hard to get people to pay attention to ads anymore. You've spoken about this a few times. And now with COVID pushing everything online, I do wonder whether people are becoming fatigued with the digital space. How do you maintain an audience's attention with something like the future? Has it gotten harder?
I don't think so. It's gotten easier.
Okay.
We have experienced massive growth on our YouTube channel this year. It took us over 6 years, almost 7 years to get to 1 million subscribers.
And it happened this year.
And, right? So we hit 1 million earlier this year. I think we're on track to hitting 2 million by the end of this year.
Damn.
So what took us 6-7 years to get to will take us in a year we can get there. So things are accelerating. And I think it's because people are hungry for content. You don't have anything to do, especially if you're on full, like real lockdown. What are you going to do with your time?
Yeah.
And you, when you are tired of binge watching some series on Netflix and you want to learn something, you're going to go to YouTube. You're going to go read an article, read a book, and you're going to find something. You're going to rediscover your passion for learning. You're going to spark that imagination and curiosity once again. And so a whole new wave of audience are coming in. Prior to this pandemic lockdown, our highest performing video had eked out 3 million views. A short that we released on YouTube just surpassed 30 million views, and it's been up since late February.
You're right.
So it's 10x our previous best viewed video. Okay, so that's just one metric. I get that. Here's another metric for you. I'm a public speaker, and I've been doing public speaking now for about 4 years, kind of on and off, but more seriously in the last couple of years. And it's a requirement for me, them obviously, to pay for my travel, hotel, those kinds of things. But also, I also want to get paid to do public speaking. And there's always a lot of pushback. Like, we can't afford it. So I say, you know what? Can you pay me $10,000 to do this? And they're like, well, we can't. We'll give you five. We'll give you seven. Why don't we do this? You do a workshop. We'll pay you for that. There's always some workaround. I don't love it, but I do it.
Interesting.
So we go on lockdown. There's no more public speaking in events and conferences, but people still want to hold events. So they're doing them virtually. And so when they get on the phone or email me, I say to them, do you have $10,000? Surprisingly, they say yes. And then the rate just gets higher and higher for less and less work. And I'm like, well, what's going on here? I'm literally doing this talk like this, same camera, same backdrop, same ugly face. I'm doing the exact same thing. But now they're willing to pay because they don't have a choice. So I think this whole lockdown, the coronavirus, has impacted our perception about what work means, where we can work, commuting, neighborhoods, like the return to the neighborhood, local businesses and supporting them instead of the chains. We're also abandoning these malls and these retail experiences that have existed because they can and people believe they should, but not because they must. And so things are changing. So one of those ideas is that what is an event without the people who are going to speak at the event? So I think before they told themselves this story, oh, it's because people want to come to a venue. People want to meet each other. They want to have fancy drinks, a pre-party, a post-party. And so those things cost a lot of money. And if they can run an event and be profitable and pay speakers what they're worth, maybe they're going to learn. I hope, fingers crossed, that when things open up, they're not going to go back to, well, we have $4,000 because I'm not taking those gigs.
Hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I would agree. I think if you go into these events, I don't really care about the food and the networking and all that stuff, because personally, if I want food, I want to eat the food that I want to eat. But like, I don't really care if they've got this stuff going on there. I'm there for the person. So yeah, I think you've identified something that I don't know if it will change. Like, I don't know if it will come back. I really don't. At least here in Australia, it doesn't feel that way because people are pretty comfortable doing, like, as an example, sales meetings, like flying to other, it's very easy to fly. Melbourne to Sydney is the biggest, the busiest plane route in the world. So like, you can go up there, like people go on a bus. There's a plane going every 10 minutes from Melbourne to Sydney because it's just cheaper to fly. And I wonder, like, why would I ever fly up for a sales meeting anymore? Like, it's perfectly fine to have this conversation with this video quality and people love it. And it's just like, it's changed everything.
Yeah, I agree. And it also created a demand for products and services that relate to higher fidelity audio and video recording, right?
Yeah.
Because people are like, they hear you on your mic with your SM7B or my Blue Baby bottle. And they're like, whoa, what is that? Why do you sound like that?
Yeah.
Oh, and then there's a shortage of microphones and lights and cameras and video switchers, right?
Yeah, it's so funny because we build media rooms or podcast rooms for clients. And I just distinctly remember April, May last year where all of a sudden the SM7B was completely sold out. We couldn't even get video decks. We were trying to upgrade our video deck and we couldn't buy one. It was crazy. Absolutely crazy. All right. I'm wary of time. I want to jump into some rapid fire questions to finish things off. What does your morning and evening routine look like at the moment?
I'm a fairly predictable person. I get up usually whenever the light hits our window because I'm a very light sleeper.
Okay.
So I'm usually up by 7 a.m. I'm usually doing about 30, 40 minutes of socials. I do this in like the infinite loop. I jump from platform to platform, answer as many questions as I can. And by the time I wrap back to the original platform, there's already a slew of new messages. So I had to just learn to stop.
Yeah.
Right. And it's how I stay connected to the community, understand what their sentiment is because I read their comments. I respond to as many as I can. And then usually I'm showered and ready to go. And I sit in front of my desk and I just try to knock out my three things for that day. And sometimes I can do one of those things. Sometimes I do zero of those things. Or sometimes when I'm being a really good person, I knock out all three things.
Okay.
Yeah.
How much of your time is spent being locked into meetings? Like, are you very strict about people having meetings with you?
Yeah, I try to have as few meetings as possible. We're a very decentralized company the way we run. And okay. So the team meets on different days and times, but I'm in none of those meetings. So very little of my time is in a meeting. If I need to know something, I will literally just ping someone on Messenger and then just we'll talk. We'll get what we need done, say our hellos and goodbyes, and then we're out.
Okay.
And then the rest of the team is just moving via probably Slack or some other channel where they're all talking to each other and using Notion to stay organized.
Okay.
We have people who work in different time zones in different parts of the world. And so they're able to tune in, get what they need, and then they're out. And every once in a while, we do need to have a team meeting so we can see each other's faces. We can see some of us got hairier, some of us got bigger, you know, put on some pounds. And just so we can say hello, it's like, okay, so you look a little different today than you did, you know, 2 months ago. And we do that. But meetings are usually super unproductive waste of time. It creates the illusion that things are happening. And usually you could just send an email.
Yeah, I agree with that. What about at night? What's your evening routine look like?
Usually what I do is I eat dinner and I'll sit in front of TV for a little while. I do need to recharge my batteries as an introvert. I spend most of my days talking to people, doing media, writing, recording, doing something like that. So I'm usually wiped out. So I'll veg out in front of the TV for a little bit. And depending on what my workload looks like, I will go back upstairs, which is where my studio is. I'll knock out whatever I need to finish for that day. And that usually gets me to about midnight. And then I start my preparations for sleep.
And what have you been watching of late?
Well, I'm watching all kinds of series. I'm on every, I've got every package from ESPN Plus to Disney to Apple to Hulu, Netflix and Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
So there's no shortage of quality content that's hitting me. I recently watched Mayor of Easttown, which stars Kate Winslet.
Yeah.
Yeah. A little slow drama and builds. And my wife wanted to watch it. I'm like, okay.
And do you rate it? Because a lot of friends have spoken about this series.
Do I like it?
Yeah. Did you like it?
I liked it. I felt some parts of the writing was a little convoluted.
Yeah.
Because it's trying to extend the whodunit part, you know, and then it gets a little crazier and crazier. I'm like, okay, all right, if you say so. So some parts, if you watch it back. If it were cut back in sequence when things happen in a linear way, it might not make any sense whatsoever. There's some funny little patches here and there. But I really like Kate Winslet as an actress and her portrayal of the character. As much as it's like a whodunit kind of situation, there's strong character building between a kind of a broken nuclear modern family.
No, it's. I mean, a lot of people have spoken about it about a month ago. I'm still watching things like House of Cards. I've only just watched that recently. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
One nice thing about the pandemic is you get caught up on all the series. All of them. Every single one of them.
Well, there's so all many memes them. About things like The Sopranos. I've never watched The Sopranos. And that's the next one on my list. So I'm just catching up. Right, last question for you. What's the best purchase under $200 that you've made in the last 2 years?
My God, under $200?
Yeah.
Probably my Stream Deck from Elgato.
Yeah,
that thing's a little beast. Yeah.
It's good, huh?
Yeah, it can do a whole bunch of things. I'm a keyboard macro automation kind of guy.
Okay.
I don't even think I've tapped into it. I haven't created custom icons yet, but the fact that it can queue up songs, sound bites, I can create shortcuts for Zoom, for Keynote and for everything else, for Photoshop, for everything. It's really super cool.
Nice.
Quite powerful.
Nice. I like it. Yeah, it's Elgato is amazing as a company product. We use Blackmagic Design only because we couldn't get the Elgato deck because it was sold out. But I do want to get the little macros with the buttons and whatnot set up. But Chris, thank you so much for doing this. I know it's the end of your day, so hopefully you get to have a break sometime soon, but enjoy your evening. Thanks for coming on the show. Where can people find you on the interwebs?
I try to make it very easy to find me. So if you're interested in what we do with the mission, the products and the courses we release, go to thefuture.com. It's F-U-T-U-R. There's no E at the end. Thefuture.com. You can find me on social media. I'm everywhere at the Chris Doe, and Doe spelled D-O.
Yeah.
That's it.
And we'll link all of that But Chris, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much, Jordan.
Thank you so much for checking out this episode. If you liked it, do subscribe. And of course, like it on YouTube if you're watching as well. We'd really appreciate that. For audio, if you've not already listening on your podcast app, you can search for it on any good app, including Spotify, Pocket Casts, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, etc. For video, if you're not watching, you can search Uncommon Podcast on YouTube. It's the first one that appears every single time. But behind the scenes, do follow us on Instagram and TikTok. It's @uncommon_show. But until next time, thanks for tuning in.